You know, when it comes to wireless carriers, sometimes what you see isn't always what you get. Except with Visible. With Visible, what you see is exactly what you get. If you haven't heard of Visible, well, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. With Visible, there are no hidden fees, no fine print, no hassle, nothing to hide. It's just $25 a month, all taxes and fees included. And you don't need more than one line of wireless to save. You can save on a line all to yourself with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon. And again, just $25 a month. The future of wireless is here, and it is transparent. If you want more transparency in your wireless plan, you want to be on the Visible plan. Switch to Visible today and save at Visible.com. That's Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com. This episode of GameScoop is sponsored by Squarespace. If you're looking for a way to make your business stand out and succeed online, Squarespace is the all-in-one website platform for you. They take the stress out of creating an awesome website, engaging with your audience, and selling anything from products to content to time, so you're able to focus on, you know, everything else. In other words, you'll have more time for gaming. With the new guided design system, you can choose from curated layouts and styling options to build a unique online presence from the ground up, optimized for every device. And with Squarespace's integrated, optimized SEO tools, you'll show up more often to more people. Squarespace doesn't just make things easier for you. Checkout for your customers is made seamless with simple but powerful payment tools that allow you to accept credit cards, PayPal, and Apple Pay, and in eligible countries, offer the option to buy now and pay later with Afterpay and Clearpay. So whether you're just starting out or looking to expand your existing brand, be sure to visit squarespace.com for a free trial, and when you're ready to launch, go to squarespace.com/gamescoop to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. That's squarespace.com/gamescoop for 10% off. What's up, everybody? Welcome to IGN GameScoop. I'm your host, Damon Hatfield. Joining me this week here in studio is Nick Lamone.
I'm back, baby.
Joining us remotely are Sam Claiborne.
Hey, what's up, studios?
And Justin Davis.
Scoop.
We got a great show for you this week. We'll talk about the Fallout show that everyone's talking about and everybody seems to be pretty entertained by. There's a bunch of new sort of smaller indie games that were announced this week, including one that we manifested on this very show last week. Please be excited for that. But first, I finally got to check out Dave the Diver because it has just been released on PlayStation Plus. So I've spent a couple hours with that. You've played it, apparently.
Yes.
And I know Sam
played it.
Sam has played it. Justin, did you play that one last year?
I made a list of games I want to play next, and Dave the Diver was at the top. And then, like you, Damon, I saw it was coming to PS Plus, so that's right. It's downloaded.
Yeah. What's that, Sam?
I actually can't play this game because it makes me too hungry.
It is all about
sushi.
Yeah, it is all about sushi.
It's expensive.
So a lot of people out there in Scoop Nation have probably already played this game, but for those who haven't, this is a roguelite deep sea diving, hunting, and also sushi shop running like. So you go diving during the day, get some fish, take it back up, and then in the evening you work the sushi restaurant. And you got a chef who will make up all the sushi, and you got to keep the customers happy. And you have to pour their green tea exactly correctly, or they will not give you a tip.
Yeah,
I actually like the sushi restaurant part of this. Not only does it make me hungry, but I didn't think that stuff was as fun. But exploring the depths is really cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's pretty challenging, too, like exploring the depths, especially early on.
Early on, they don't give you that much time until your oxygen runs out.
Yeah.
And you have a harpoon that's pretty weak, so you can only spear a very small fish. You can't even get jellyfish when you're first starting out. But then very soon after, you meet a guy who's like, here's a gun. Take this gun underwater, and now you can shoot up your fish. You can up the jellyfish.
Heck yeah.
Yeah. You can absolutely destroy the jellyfish. You don't want to eat them anyway.
I mean,
you
need them in a salad. That's the thing.
Really?
I like games that are low stakes, where it's like, Dave, if this gets hard, just quit. You're not saving the world. Like, you don't have to do any of this. This is all your own choice.
Yeah. You don't even need, just get the regular sushi. Just get the regular fish. Just get tuna and mackerel and yellowtail, and you'll be fine.
Dave aspires for more in life, though.
the production of like the cutscenes and how they look is really high. Like it's kind of surprising sometimes. You're like, whoa, there's a lot going on in this game.
It's like it's pixel art, but then it has very cinematic cutscenes that are also pixel art with like giant characters that you don't see very often.
Yeah.
I think
that's exactly. It's like its own thing. It looks like its own game.
The thing that always impressed me about Dave the Diver is just like how unselfish it is with just dealing out new mechanics left and right over the course of the entire game. Like it's like well past the point in a lot of games where you're like, surely they will never introduce a new mechanic at this point. I can do everything I can possibly do in this game. And then Dave the Diver's like, what about this one more thing? And there's just always so many different little mini games, mechanics, and so much more.
Yeah. Yeah, I can already see what the gameplay loop is. Very fun to set up.
You're going to play for the Godzilla content?
I'm absolutely going to play for the Godzilla content. That's one reason why I'm jumping in now. Mm. In the couple hours I've spent with it, nothing out of the ordinary. I've encountered just regular fish that you would find. Although there was a cutscene where a giant tentacle dragged a boat underwater. So imagine somewhere along the lines there'll be some bigger.
Yeah, and even in the footage we're watching, there's some fantasy stuff that they introduced in the trailers. I have a question about Godzilla.
Mm-hmm.
Is sushi?
Well, we talked about this before.
He eats sushi. Yeah.
Do you eat? He's a lizard.
He's like you could probably make a tasty gyukatsu out of Godzilla.
I think you'd want to cook Godzilla first. Although it's already pretty radiated.
Radiated, yeah, that's fair.
So I don't know.
Well, that's some Fallout territory. Isn't the origin of Godzilla, even though he's lizard-like, he is a sea creature. He lives in the ocean.
Yeah, yes, yes.
And he can swim underwater indefinitely. He doesn't need to come up to breathe, right? So he's a fish.
He's an amphibian, though, because he can breathe air. He can do both.
Mm-hmm. So, are amphibians sushi ever? Eel, right? Those are just straight-up reptiles that live in the ocean. Another fish.
Yeah. Eel are just fish snakes.
Yeah, but I think you eat eels cooked when you have it as sushi. You're not eating the raw eel. Although maybe in Japan they will eat
raw eel. I think you can eat raw eel.
Yeah, I don't think you're going to find that in an American sushi place.
No.
It's funny how that distinction is made, huh?
Yeah. I don't know. You wouldn't eat raw alligator, probably.
Someone was like, hey, you want to try some raw, I'll be like, I would just trust you that, like, I can ingest this raw, you know? If you present it to me in that way, I'm like, okay, sure.
Well, you bring very trusting.
Yeah. I think, and it's weird that you only eat the eel with, you know, that one barbecue sauce and, like, you know, sometimes it's toasted and some other things.
Exactly.
It must not actually taste good. They're just like, well, listen, we got to eat this eel.
It was pretty tasty. That unagi sauce, also tasty.
Have you had it without barbecue sauce?
Wait, barbecue sauce or unagi sauce?
Sam's mean.
got it. Yeah, it's fine.
I was also surprised to learn...
I'm just glad.
Dave the Diver is not an indie game.
No. It is not an indie game.
I thought it was just... I knew it was a Korean developer, but I thought it was just like an independent Korean outfit, but no, it's Nexon.
Yeah, a subsidiary, small development team within Nexon.
Yeah.
So, like, they have...
Literally one of the biggest companies on the planet.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so a real problem for 20 questions.
Yes. That would be tough.
Oh, man.
I mean, I maintain, just like alternative music, that indie is a genre. I do not think it is a reflection of the economic conditions of the developer. Because otherwise, Insomniac, prior to its acquisition, would have been indie. And why is an Electronic Arts indie? They're not owned by a first party.
It's probably true. It's probably more useful to use it as not a genre than a description of the type of game.
Yeah, it's definitely a word that needs to be reevaluated in its use in 2024.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm really excited to play this. There's a long history on GameScoop of us loving games or games where you go down below. And then you go back up to the surface and do something with what you got down below. That's SteamWorld Dig.
Yep.
You know, that's just many video games over the years. And it's one of those formulas, like games with these two halves. And then, you know, it's just fun. It's a fun way to design and play a game.
Yep.
Yes, it's delving. Delving core.
Yeah. Love it.
Anyway, it's good to finally have Dave the Diver on PlayStation, on PlayStation Plus. And I'm very much looking forward to the Godzilla content, however that works out. Sam, as an update, I believe you've finally gone on a date with Tifa.
I did, yes.
Oh, wow.
And I believe I had the non-intimate date. Nick, do you know about the distinctions here?
Oh, you bet I do.
Yeah, okay. So let me get this straight. If you do a lot of stuff right, then your date with Tifa has a slightly longer cutscene with an extra thing that I watched online. Is that basically all it is?
That's correct.
And then And then does anything that has to do with the dates in that game cause Cloud to not have his shirt on, or is that just the way our staff recorded every one of those stupid videos?
It's the way our staff recorded the... They just, because after you beat the game, you unlock the ability to play through the entire game in alternate costumes.
Someone thought it was a very funny joke to play through. So we paired up the cutscenes. It's like you can get the date and then the intimate date. And for every date, it just shows it. And then the intimate date, Cloud is naked. And I was like, this is really going to throw people off. Because that is not what makes it intimate.
That's a very different context.
Yeah. But I think the difference between the intimacies is like, you know, you get a hug or a high five. Like, it's like stuff. It's not like, there's, you know, Cyberpunk.
It's not like, or Mass Effect.
Correct.
It's not like a shower scene.
It's all tasteful. Everything done is tasteful.
Yeah. But it does solidify a romance. Mm. Like, it's kind of like shocking in that way, because they'll probably wipe all the progress in the third game and nothing will matter. Mm-hmm. But like, it is weird because I was super scared that I was going to be on a second date with Aerith. The first one was just dreadful.
Wow, you really don't like Aerith, huh?
I'm not saying that. I just was trying to go on a date with Tifa, and I got saddled with Aerith. Right? That's what happened. Okay, and I did everything right, I thought. Then I looked up the guide, and I was like, oh, I had to do this part. All the same. So I made sure to use a guide to make sure this Tifa thing happened. But at the start of your date, at the Golden Saucer, the second date, the one that matters, Aerith comes out and like starts talking about a song she's writing, and I was like, no. So it's like it got really tense there for a little bit. And so it all went well, the gate with Tifa went well. For like 45 minutes I didn't touch the controller in this, though. I mean, you do play this like mini game a little bit during the opera scene, but that opera scene is unhinged. It is nuts. So crazy, and it's like you can't read. They're wearing VR goggles, and then they play characters. And you can choose the character's roles, and it's like, it's just so wild. And then there's a lot of permutations, it looks like, too, because you can, like, I don't know. It's so hard to explain, but, like, it's like an entire weird dating game and, like, opera scene, like, that just takes, you set aside an hour. Like, it's just going to take that long.
Yeah.
It also raises a lot of questions in world about how the VR technology works. Like, is everybody watching the show that Cloud is? Are they 100%. All? Are they all the hero here? Because
was the VR crowd cheering for Aerith singing a song to everybody?
I need to know how it works.
Because at the end of it, they all just take off their VR headsets. I'm like, what? But then they go on the Ferris wheel, and that's where they hug or whatever.
And no big deal. I got the intimate Tifa scene without a guide.
I think the hard ones are Yuffie, because she gets there a little bit later in the game, and then Barret, right? Barret was always difficult in the original.
Yeah,
Barret is really
almost
tough
like
to
an
do.
Easter egg. Yeah. You had to like go out of your way. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's all of our footage being shirtless Cloud, even though that's completely optional. It is a little bit. There's a famous, I think it's the Final Fantasy VII official guide from Brady, where you can name your characters in that game, and they named Ares, you know, Ares at that time, Biatch.
Yes, I do. I have
that's
that
the guide.
Yes, I have that strategy
like,
guide.
What?
Yeah, yeah.
Hold on, I need to look it up.
Because whoever was, you know, responsible for capturing those thousands of screenshots named, like, I don't think any of the other ones are like that bad or egregious, but like Cloud is something silly too. Like all the characters are just renamed to something dumb.
Why did they change Aerith's name?
I mean,
I'm looking at it right here.
Oh, no, I mean, not to the name you're saying, but why did they change her name officially?
It's a localization.
The Ares to Aerith thing?
Yeah,
it was a big sort of controversy with nerds back in the 90s where,
because it's,
you know,
it's like Erisu is how you would read it, which would be A-E-R-I-S-U. And so the localizer was like, I don't know, Eris, whereas it's more like Erith. Is what how it's supposed to be, but yeah, it's the Su Hiragana.
Has it been that way for a long time?
Oh yeah,
And I feel like the super nerds were like, you know, like it was a movement to like because you can rename characters in the game, like rename her Aerith, don't use Ares.
You know who used to yell? Used to yell about Ares all the time was Kratos.
Ares. In that.
Eris also kills Cloud's family and then puts all of their ashes on him. So cinematic parallels.
Well, you know, eventually Kratos becomes Eris.
In that strategy guide, Cloud is named Smooth.
Man, they don't.
Wait, so which strategy guide is it? I have one of them.
Is it Prima Games?
I'm trying to find a. It's the official one, but I'm not.
It's the
like
official
logo.
Strategy guide, which I think was Brady.
Brady, you are right. It's correctly. Brady. Because it's the one with That's the C- CG rendition of Cloud looking at the reactor. Whereas the unofficial guide was like a hand-drawn cover.
Yeah.
You know, I like that, like, if you're worried about people stealing your game footage or things like that, like, just dress your character. There was some game where I think John Ryan or somebody, like, they spent the entire game having their character in, like, this obnoxious blue hat. Yeah. And then it's like, well, we'll know if they used our footage.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, we had somebody, for the first Mass Effect, somebody... Maybe it was Nate Ahern. I remember made a character that was so awful looking.
We couldn't
use the video for anything after that. It'd be like, oh, let's look back at the best games ever. Like, look at the footage and it's just awful. It's just this like fish man.
I remember that too.
Amazing.
Oof. Well, congrats on your milestone, Sam.
You're
probably at least 10% through Final Fantasy VII Rebirth now.
I know. Where am I at?
You're like 70% there.
Oh my God.
it's a long ass game.
And then real quick, Sam, what is Mini Shoot Adventures?
Okay.
Oh, that game's so good.
I played two games this year that would go in my best of game of the year watch list. And one of them is Prince of Persia. Mm-hmm. And the other is this. I love it. It is a Zelda clone, but it's a twin stick shooter. So it really has the very first Legend of Zelda through, you know, the 90s games like the Game Boy One, stuff like that. And of course, Link to the Past. It has that feel because the overworld is all trees and cliffs and caves and stuff like that. But you're just a little spaceship. And you upgrade your spaceship and it gets bullet helly really fast. That's the way it kind of, you know, ratchets.
Oh my God.
Dude, this is so sick.
Yeah. You can do a little bit of drifting and sliding and bursting. Like, I'm already upgrading. I've only beat the first dungeon. The upgrades you get are really cool dodgies and, like, you know, you get great guns. And I can't even believe some of the guns I'm seeing right now. But yeah, it is made so, it's balanced so well that I'm dying and it's difficult and it's fun and it's pretty and sounds great. And it's just, there's nothing not to like.
Wow.
GameScoop Nation will love it.
This looks amazing.
I also have played through the first dungeon. So we're at about the same spot.
Nice.
And it's great. I play a lot of shmups. I wouldn't describe it. It's hard, but it's not punishing. Like, you just kind of restart at the checkpoint, and like, I never feel
and
like
you can grind.
Yeah,
which is awesome.
It looks like Geometry Wars Zelda, which is like, that's a thing I didn't know I wanted.
Yeah, it's really good.
Yeah, and just the exploration secret stuff alone is like great. Like, it's the overworld feels so familiar in that kind of like, I know what I'm looking for. You know, Zelda thing, but everything's different, you know, like, it's just, I don't know. You'll sync up with it really quickly.
I think it's really good.
Yeah, I'm playing it on Steam. Is it only on PC now?
It's only on Steam.
Anybody try it on Steam Deck yet? Cause that's probably how I want to play.
I'm only playing it on Deck. Yeah.
Great. I will buy this when I get home today.
It's perfect.
It also has an overwhelmingly positive rating on Steam. So we are not alone.
Loved it.
I gotta check that out. Real quick, Nick, anything else you've been playing recently?
Well, not to dive too much into our next topic, but after watching the Fallout TV show,
there you go.
I decided to go way back, and I'm revisiting the original Fallout, Fallout Classic, and
Fallout.
And my God, what a game that still holds up to this day. Granted, there's some stickiness, especially up front. There's a lot of quality of life changes that I think we take for granted in 2024, where the game will just straight up kill you at the beginning of the game. You'll die to a cave of rats if you don't know how the combat works. But once you get past that immediate hump and you figure out the mechanics, it's just a game that really reminds me why I fell in love with Fallout, because Fallout 3 was my first, like, oh, Fallout's cool. That's post-apocalyptic. But Fallout 1, 2, and Planescape Torment were like one of the first three games I picked up when I got my first gaming PC. And to me, it's just like, they made me fall in love with Fallout as a world. And yeah, it's so good to revisit these old games just in terms of RPG choices. And it is really interesting to weigh like how RPG choices weigh in the story outcomes of the original Fallout versus something like Fallout 4, where I would argue it's all pretty minor. It's a shooter with a couple dialogue trees, whereas the original Fallout, a lot of wild stuff can happen. It does not hold your hand any way, shape, and form. And I just really, really like it. And if you like the TV show, honestly, this is a great thing to play immediately afterwards, given that this is set in LA. It's about a vault that loses its water chip, and now you have to venture out into the wasteland for the first time and find a working water chip and bring it back home. And then madness ensues.
It looks very different from the other Fallouts. Was this made by Bethesda? Who made this?
No, this is Black Isle Studios, and they would later become like Obsidian, right? I think I might have that a little bit around, but mixed up. But I believe Fallout 2 is Obsidian, question mark? But both Black Isle Studios, I know that.
Mm-hmm. But this is so janky. It looks so funny.
But a lot
of
the
isometric.
Yeah.
Yeah, go ahead.
A lot of the talent would go forward and like go on to become Obsidian and make like Fallout New Vegas. Like I know Chris Avellone was a part of this, as was, I believe, Josh Sawyer was on Fallout 2, and then he eventually went to be direct New Vegas and things like that. But this is just like, this feels like one of those canon games for PC gamers to me. This feels like an important text for PC gaming.
So the first one was done by Interplay.
That's a publisher,
right? What's the combat in this game?
They developed it.
Oh, they developed it? Oh, okay, yeah. There you go. I'm sorry, Matt, Sam?
What's the combat?
It is a stop and kind of like a... It's like a turn-based RPG, but it's all determined like based on your special stats and whatnot.
And Fallout 2
it's all dice
Black
rolls and like...
Yes.
Dice rolls?
Yeah, dice rolls.
You mentioned that cave. I mean, I played this game when I was 11 and didn't really understand what was going on. And there's a cave, like you get out of the vault and the very first thing you do, like it's the first thing you do. You're in a cave and you fight like two rats. And then everyone that plays that game dies because you don't know what you're doing. And it's like you attack the rat and miss, and you attack the rat and miss, and then you're dead. And then it's like, well,
why is that?
It's like the hardcore RPG. Because
it's a PC game from the 90s. It's
like, what are you supposed to do, I'm saying?
It's essentially like if you build your character incorrectly stat-wise, like if you forget to put any points in your agility, you just straight up don't know how to use a gun, so you miss every single shot. So like as a kid, when I first picked it up, it's like, everything, I'm not doing any damage. What's going on? And then I decided to pick a pre-configured character. And it's like, oh, I see what I did. But I think it's like that level of friction, right? It reminds me a lot of Morrowind, where it looks like you're hitting an enemy in the game, but it's just missing because your stats aren't high enough. So it's like that Dungeons & Dragons style RPG mechanic where numbers aren't high enough. Even though it looks like my character is making contact with you, the game is telling you, you missed.
It's this willingness to, like, if you don't have the right stats, like, you will not be able to shoot a gun. Mm-hmm. And, like, the game's willingness to, like, let you build your character in a way of, like, you know, like, you need to be melee, like, you need to specialize and you need to be thoughtful about how you build your character. And, you know, there's good and bad that comes along with that. You could completely screw yourself, but then it also gives you, like, a really meaningfully different way to play the game if you want to approach it in these different ways.
And you can make a stupid character.
I was gonna say, like, I think I don't know about Fallout 1. I think Fallout either 1 or 2, one of them you never need to fight in the whole game. Like, you can talk the final boss into killing themselves, and that's how you win.
Cool.
That's the first one. Yeah.
Is it the first one?
But yeah, you can make a character with one intelligence, and they just literally all their dialogue choices get changed to grunts like a caveman.
Yeah. Yeah.
Cool.
Highly recommend. And there's a lot of lore locations that you see from the show. In this original Fallout.
Can you
Fallout.
Play a version of this that's like not the, you know, you having to load up a, you know, a Windows 95 emulator?
This was, it's available on Steam, but it is always going to look like this.
Yeah.
The game runs fine. I don't think you'll run into any issues running this on just about any piece of hardware. But cool. Yeah, it's a very good time.
This episode of Game Scoop is brought to you by NordVPN. As Scoop Nation knows, your Omega Cops have been a little obsessed with a movie called Weekend at Bernie's lately. But as happens too often these days, it is difficult to find it streaming here in the US. That's where NordVPN comes in. With NordVPN, you can switch your virtual location to a more enlightened region where they appreciate the comic delights of Weekend at Bernie's. And it's not just for streaming movies and shows. Switching your virtual location can allow you to save money by purchasing flights, hotels, and subscriptions from other countries at a cheaper price. And you can do all this worry-free as NordVPN threat protection features protect you from viruses, malware, and phishing sites. Best of all, NordVPN costs the price of a cup of coffee a month, and one account can be used on up to 6 devices. To get the best discount on your NordVPN plan, go to nordvpn.com/gamescoop. Our link will also give you 4 extra months on the 2-year plan. There's no risk with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. That's nordvpn.com/gamescoop. 1 in 5 Americans has learned a new language on their bucket list, or life backlog, if you will. If that's you, make 2024 the year you finally check it off the list with Babbel. Upgrade your personal skill set in 2024 with Babbel, the science-backed language learning app that actually works. Babbel's quick 10-minute lessons are handcrafted by over 200 language experts to help you start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. Its tips and tools are approachable, accessible, rooted in real-life situations, and delivered with conversation-based teaching so you're ready to practice what you've learned in the real world. I have a trip to Mexico coming up, so I've been using Babbel to brush up on my Spanish. The courses are short and sweet, so I can do one whenever I have a few minutes to spare. And the words and phrases it teaches you are designed for practical, real-world use, like ordering at a restaurant or asking for directions. Babbel can even provide you feedback on your pronunciation with its speech recognition tech. And it's not just for Spanish. Babbel includes 14 different language courses, each backed by a 20-day money-back guarantee. Here's a special limited-time deal for Scoop Nation. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, only for our listeners, at babbel.com/gamescoop. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/gamescoop, spelled BABBEL.com/gamescoop. Rules and restrictions may apply.
Well, speaking of Fallout, it's the latest video game adaptation done right. Everyone loves the series. I'm 4 episodes in, so I'm halfway done. You finished it, Nick.
Mm-hmm.
Sam, or did you start last night, Sam?
One episode. Yeah, no, I've only seen one episode.
And Justin, how about you?
I'm going to watch more.
I have just the finale left, cool. So I'm, 7 episodes through.
Oh,
and I don't care about spoilers, so just talk about whatever you want.
Yeah, well, you don't want to spoil.
Damon does.
We don't want to do spoilers here.
I mean, anyway. In the episode, the first 2 episodes or whatever that Damon's seen.
Got it.
I've done 4 episodes. Anyway, are we all in agreement that it's very good?
I think it's yes. Very good.
I think. Did you like the first episode, Sam?
Its potential. Yeah, it was all right. It was a little over the top.
All right.
I think it drags a little in the middle. It actually, and the show even lampshades it of like, I keep getting sidetracked by BS. It's like a character says at some point. Like, it feels like the video games, and it feels like Fallout in particular, where you're on a quest, you're on a mission, and then sometimes the game makes you, you know, it's like, no, before you can do that, you have to do this, and before you do this, you have to go do that. And like, so I didn't enjoy episodes like maybe 3, 4, 5 as much, but it starts really strong, and then I think it finishes really strong and kind of meanders a bit in the middle. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of like, it's entertaining television, but like nothing happened for like an hour.
Well, I do agree. It's very entertaining, especially that first episode. Like, it has a really cool opening flashback sequence about the bombs. And then immediately they introduce Lucy in the vault, and she's like so likable, right? Yeah, so right. Charismatic. She's so cool. It's like, this is the best lead character of a show I've seen in a long time. She's so cool. And then like, in a really short amount of time, you meet so many different characters that are all likable, and then a lot of stuff happens, and then it's over, but it's only like 30 minutes into the episode. Mm-hmm. So like, they packed so much into there.
And it kind of blew my mind, like lore stuff in it, like that the vaults were connected. I don't remember that ever being the case. I thought they were so far apart. That was a really interesting twist. I mean, I'm sure it's happened, but I don't
know. That's unique to those vaults.
Yeah.
That's like each vault has its own, I don't want to spoil anything. Each vault has its own kind of thing going on. And that's the thing with those vaults.
Okay, got it.
If I had a criticism of the first episode, it's just that, so you got 3 main characters, right? Lucy, the ghoul, and the Brotherhood of Steel guy. I feel like Lucy and the ghoul are set up really well, instantly likable, and then the Brotherhood of Steel guy is like, who's this guy? I don't really have a reason to care about him yet. Now I'm at where he's, you know, out there in the suit, and he's got his own squire, which is a very cool dynamic, and things are getting better at that, but that's my own little...
Yeah, I think the show does a good job of like getting the standard like fish out of water style narrative and adapting it for your three main characters, but also setting them into like the inevitable moment, right? Like with Maximus and his squire, he was a squire, he becomes something indifferent, mm-hmm. and then the dynamic suddenly shifts. So that's like a nice, hey, what happens when somebody gets a little bit of power? And that's like, I like that. It seems like the screenwriters are focused on kind of figuring out each theme for each character and writing that for the entirety of season one, at least. And I really, really appreciate that. And I think this show does what a lot of video game shows or a lot of video game adaptations fail to do, is just simply tell a different story within the fiction of this established universe. You have a giant ass world that's been nuked. Tell a different story of it. This show would fail if it was just a retelling of Fallout 3, yeah. if it was a retelling of Fallout 4. There's no need to do that. Tell something completely unique. There's so much iconography. There's so much, in-world lore to support independent stories.
Why don't you do that with Star Wars?
There's more than four planets in Star Wars, apparently.
I don't even remember. So I haven't played a Fallout game since Fallout 4, mm-hmm. which is almost 10 years ago. Are the knights, were they always jerks? Are all of them jerks?
Yes.
This is more closer in line to how they are in Fallout 1 and 2.
Okay.
Whereas in 3, they kind of became like the poster boy for the series. Mm-hmm. And so they became cool.
There's different chapters mm-hmm. of the Knights of Brotherhood. And the ones in Fallout 3 and 4 are a little bit more heroic. Whereas, they're kind of just assholes. And,
yeah, just
like across other Fallout lore. I've been watching it with my wife, and she hasn't played the video games at all, but likes sci-fi stuff and likes post-apocalyptic stuff. And so that's been my like litmus test of like, does this, mm-hmm. is this going to go over with normies? And like, the answer seems to be mostly yes, but she does think that the show is quote gross.
It is pretty gross.
I like that part. I like that part of it.
Yeah, it's extremely violent and over the top. I don't care one way or the other. I'm a little bit indifferent to it. But it's like, for a show that's clearly trying to hit like four quadrants, like let's hit video game fans and men and women and young and old. Like, let me rephrase that statement. Maybe it's not trying to do that, because like, it's extremely gory.
Yeah, but the games are, with the VAT system, you can target and blow off limbs and heads. And
this show does a good job of kind of juggling the... the lighthearted humor side of the Fallout universe with a lot of the super serious, grim, dark realizations that, we are in a world that humanity nuked itself, and now the last vestiges of humanity are trying to figure out how to retain their humanity in a world that is basically turning any sort of innocence extinct. So, like, that's pretty serious. And then you have some funny jokes thrown in between that light and the movie. It walks the line perfectly, I think.
It does a great job of like, I'd heard before I watched the show, like, it's pretty funny. Like, it's funnier than people think it's going to be. Mm-hmm. But the funny moments aren't like, look, here's a joke. Here's a comedy moment. This is a comedy bit. It's like Fallout in the sense that it's just weird and off kilter and kooky. And like, it's not like, okay, here's this comedy skit or like a comic relief character. But just like, Lucy will meet somebody that's just a weirdo. Mm-hmm. And like, they have a weird interaction and then she goes on her way. And it feels very Fallout like, very pitch perfect in its tone, and in its, the wasteland is just full of a cast of weirdos and they all hate being there. and that weird Damon, if you watch the four episodes, like the one where she's talking to the guy about the water and then he drinks all their water and then it's like, it's like, you can come live with me if you want, and she's like, no thank you. And moments like that are just perfect. I think
there's a lot of people concerned that the show pre-release would avoid a lot of the weird NPC style interactions, but one of the common sentiments I'm seeing that I completely agree with is that the show creators basically toggled on the Wild Wasteland perk so that you can see some of the weird things that the Wasteland has to offer in this quote-unquote playthrough of a Fallout story, which is so fun. It's a fun way of viewing a cinematic story.
I think they did a really good job adapting this away from so what you just showed of Fallout 1, and then also Fallout 3 is in New Vegas, are squarely in that gray zone of color for video games, where like everything was kind of gray or brown.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I think that they did a really good job making this not look like that. It's like even it's immediately apparent from our review and from the trailers and from the show I've watched, where it's like, yes, there's like nuclear wasteland stuff, but then there's just a lot of color to the universe and a lot of like neat looking places and neat looking people. I think that's super smart.
Sam, in it's episode 3 or 4, there will be an audio cameo that you will enjoy.
Nice. The sets are amazing.
Everything looks great.
They're they're legit amazing. I can't believe how cool they.
That dude from Lost shows up. I don't remember that. I don't remember his character's name on Lost, but he's the bad guy on Lost.
I remember him. Yeah, the Fallout. One thing about Fallout is that you go into interiors and like it's like, oh, there's that 50s desk again 600 times because they just copy pasted everything. But you get a sense of the aesthetic. But in this, they really didn't do that a whole lot. Like, there's a lot of like really cool looking 50s inspired sci-fi tech, which I just love. I just love that part of it. This is the best version of Fallout's aesthetic that I've seen.
Yeah.
As an LA native, it is so fun to see them portray LA like locations that are well known but Falloutified. So like in the trailer, we saw Griffith Observatory that looks like a compound. It's just like they do such a good job of set decorating it to make it feel like, yeah, maybe if I was a raider, I would turn Griffith Observatory into a compound like that. Like, I believe it. Also,
got the high ground.
My theory, Philly, the town that you visit early on in the show, Philly, is it a landfill that they've just like repurposed? Yeah. Because that's very cute.
It is. I don't know that that's ever in the text of the show, but in like interviews or something like that. Like, yeah, it's meant to be a landfill.
Because I was like, why the name Philly? And I was like, landfill. Yeah, that's got to be it.
two more quick observations. I'm a little surprised at how well it works, because Jonathan Nolan, even though I've liked a lot of his stuff, this tone is very different. He's usually much more serious with like Westworld, Dark Knight, Interstellar, The Prestige. Mm-hmm. And so he's like, I don't know if he's written all the episodes or a handful of them. He directed the first three. Yeah, the tone works really well.
I think him and Lisa Joy do a good job of kind of extrapolating on why video games are interesting mechanically and how you can kind of adapt that for a more passive experience, a la watching a TV show. I think Westworld did a good job of being a video game that you watch, and I think that this is in a similar vein.
It's amazing that this was kind of in co-production with Last of Us, and they're being compared to each other, and they're both such a a critical and seemingly public darling.
Mm-hmm.
It's really neat.
Yeah.
What a weird time to be in.
I know. All of a sudden, there's just all these video game adaptations that are working. Of course, then we've got Borderlands coming up, and we'll see how that turns out.
How is that going to surpass this?
So we might as well transition into Golden Axe. Yeah, Golden Axe animated series.
We're talking about this.
From the creator of Star Trek Lower Decks, which I haven't watched. Did you watch that, Sam? You're our resident.
Yeah, it's great.
Trekkie.
Justin has too.
Oh, okay.
I hear it's good.
Sounds good.
Oh, it's so fun. Yeah, it's great. And it has like some cool through line stuff. And then it's set in the Next Generation era. So it's like, or right after it. And so it has like a bunch of references to really funny, familiar characters and Deep Space Nine episode and stuff like that. It's great.
Mm-hmm. Well, Sega wants in. Sega wants their own
Golden Axe, though.
Video game adaptation on TV, and they've gone with Golden Axe. I mean, they've already got Sonic the Hedgehog. There's a million Sonic cartoons.
Yeah.
And movies now, too.
Now they're going to have Julius Thunderclad on the silver screen.
Yeah, so the synopsis is veteran warriors, axe battler Tyrus Flair and Gilius Thunderhead, as they once again battle to save Yuria from the evil giant Death Adder, who just won't seem to stay dead. But this time they have the inexperienced and underprepared Hampton Squibb on their side. So a new character for the show.
Is Gnome?
Maybe Gnome. And that's going to be Danny Pudi from Community.
Mm-hmm.
Doing that voice. And then Gilius the Dwarf will be voiced by Matthew Rhys, who you recognize. And he's also the dad on The Americans, but he's been in a million things. That's just the way, when I look at him, I don't think dwarf.
That's fair.
I mean, I think it's great. I mean, I think Lower Decks, if you haven't watched it, like it makes fun of Star Trek. Like it's like a Rick and Morty or a, Futurama. Like it's very zany and fast paced and, like poking fun at the source material, but without being like rude about it. So it like straddles that line well. So I think that something like Golden Axe, you can already see the show. Like it's going to be very silly and just zany and just what was that Matt Groening fantasy show that he made a few seasons up for Netflix? Like,
right?
I wouldn't be. Yeah,
Sam watched
like
that.
This could be kind of like Disenchanted-esque.
Mm. Yeah, and like, you can see it being the, you know, the fantasy mirror to the sci-fi production of Lower Decks. You know, one thing that I like about Lower Decks is that the characters are also fans of the famous people in the Star Trek universe. So they like can't freaking believe it all the time when they get to be involved in something that involves Picard or something like that, you know? So that's like a really cool aspect of that, and it kind of ties the show together. Otherwise, it could be kind of including a bunch of Star Trek jokes. It could be more of a just sci-fi funny cartoon. That really works for it. For Golden Axe, like, nobody cares about this. they won't be able to do that, but it could just be a fun fantasy cartoon. And, you know, I mean, fantasy plus dinosaurs is pretty funny. That's basically what all the Golden Axe is. Like, if you had to narrow it down, like, that's basically all.
It feels like in line with what I would I heard about it and I immediately thought of that old The Guild. It was like a Flash animation web cartoon thing with like Felicia Day, and it was like, oh, I'm immediately brought back to like the late aughts of just internet gaming humor. So I'm hoping it's a little more advanced than that, but who knows.
A shout out to another fantasy cartoon that's coming out. Hello from the Magic Tavern got finally picked up as a cartoon, and that's a fantastic podcast foundation for fantasy humor. And I'm really looking forward to that.
Ooh,
man! I haven't thought about Hello from the Magic Tavern in a while. I stopped listening to podcasts when I stopped commuting.
Yeah, I know that's the time, right? Standing on Muni.
I don't know if anyone has watched The Legend of Vox Machina on Amazon Prime, but it's an animated fantasy Dungeons & Dragons show where a group of adventurers where everyone's a different class goes out on quests together, and it's humorous, which kind of sounds like what this is trying to be. And Legend of Vox Machina is actually very good. So, we're actually seeing it right here.
What about Dungeon Delicious? Did that ever finish?
Delicious in Dungeon.
Whew. Yeah, that Delicious finished. In Dungeon.
Still so good.
Very good. Different thing. Great. Different thing, but yeah, very good. Still, that's done now. It's
still airing.
I thought it was over.
No, that's still airing,
What? I stopped watching. I thought it was done, like, weeks ago.
Yeah, I think it's going to be 24 or 25 episodes, and right now it's at, like, episode...
Oh,
today.
Gosh.
I think today is, like, episode 18.
Wow, I've got some catching up to do.
Yeah, I love it. I love it so much. The manga is very good, so it holds the high bar for me.
Who do we talk to? We have to pump the brakes on content coming out this year, on games, TV shows. It's too much. I cannot keep up with everything.
I got a lot of movies to catch up on too.
All, you know, I made sure I watched some Fallout so we could talk about this on the show. But all I really want to do with my evenings is play Balatro these days.
Whew.
That's all I really want to do.
You could play Fallout and, or you can watch Fallout and play Balatro.
No, I don't do this. I don't know. distracted TV watching.
Focus. I don't know. I feel like a lot of modern TV, though, is like, you don't really need to pay attention to it 100%. It's not like I'm watching a movie here. So I will say...
I hate that.
I will say Fallout is not like an all-in for me where I'm 100% locked in. I don't think that anything in the show...
Well, what are you playing while watching Fallout? We must know.
Well, like Balatro. Like something a little more... Or like a Slay the Spire where I can do something a little more autonomously. But I will say a lot of modern TV does feel like... just people standing in rooms talking at each other. There's nothing particularly cinematic.
You think it's more like that today than it was 40 years ago?
No. I'm just saying TV in general. TV in general.
You could describe life on this earth as people standing in rooms talking to each other.
But a cinematic experience is meant to be more. You're supposed to tell a story with the moving picture, not just a story, not just an audio book. And that's what a lot of TV shows are.
I hate this.
No, well, I'm with Justin.
Hey, I'm a cinematic arts major, so I'm allowed to be foofy about it.
Okay, there is a visual language of film and storytelling that, you know, because of the pace that television is filmed at, that they don't have a lot of time
to
do.
It's not utilized, which is fine. Yeah. That's okay.
I completely am on the Justin Damon side here, but I will say, think how much you could get done in Factorio while watching
series. I'd end up screwing up my whole factory so bad.
But like, I want to keep watching Fallout, but I haven't even gotten to Shogun yet. And I know that I'm going to love Shogun.
Yeah. And, well, the good news is that by the time you get to it, it'll all be done.
Yeah. I mean, yeah.
I'm caught up. I'm not in the, you know, the 11 out of 10 show that other people are, but it's so good.
Mm. It's very
really, really good.
That is a show that I have to pay attention to because that one does actually understand
beautiful
cinematic storytelling as a visual medium.
Also, gross as hell.
Very
what?
Gross.
That one's gross too? Oh my God, I'm going to love it.
It's very gross.
I'm going to love it.
There's one episode where I was like, I didn't think you could show that on TV. That was nuts.
Seriously. It's so gory. It's
oh my God.
So messed up.
It rules.
Like, I don't know. We're in a weird era of heightened gore, for sure.
I mean, we're going to need a new
You can't show that category on television.
We have best kill gag already, but maybe I just need goriest show now.
There is a pretty great kill in Shogun.
The kill, that is so gross. It just must have smelled so bad.
You guys are really getting me intrigued.
And then you bring it up to history buffs, and they're like, yes, people actually did that all the time in Japan. Like, okay. I don't want to know this.
But thankfully, at least, Sam, it sounds like I can skip Sasquatch Sunset. Is that right?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I mean, oh man, Alamo Drafthouse put so much into that. I went on like Saturday and they had like, you know, cutouts you could stand in front of. They had a movie prop of this like Sasquatch baby. They had like a giant vat of buttons that was like, take whatever you want. You know, all that type of thing. It was like full investment in Sasquatch Sunset, which is like, only a mistake Alamo Drafthouse could make an investment, right? And it was me and my two friends in the theater.
Oh.
I think and we were in the back, and I think the only other seats that were this is the whole movie, by the way, entire movie. I think there was two other seats taken, and that was like, you know, the Saturday of opening. And critics are giving this like crazy reviews. We gave it a 10. There's a New Yorker article with one of their like best films critics that glowingly talks about it. But also, like, I read that before the movie. And since there's only so many things you can do while watching Sasquatch just walk around in the woods, I knew the whole movie already. There wasn't spoilers because like there's no plot, but like, you know, that didn't help. But it was just insane. It's like what it just said there. Everybody's like, oh, there's these like poignant moments. No, there's not. It's just the Sasquatch smelling a fucking skunk. That's the poignant moment. You just saw it. That's it.
I just love the idea that the New Yorker spoiled the entirety of a movie.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That's funny.
You can read that instead. But yeah, I mean, there's nothing, you know, there's beautiful nature shots in it. Like every once in a while, they take a porcupine out of the zoo and put it in front of the like a really nice camera, and it looks amazing. There's a badge, so cute. But yeah, you can watch the trailer and then catch up. I wouldn't even recommend renting this or whatever, streaming it at home. Like if you force somebody to watch this with you, they will be mad at you. they're gonna be like, why did you do this? So do it only as a joke. And I convinced two friends to go, right? And one of them, she liked it a little bit. And then my other friend thought it was just absolutely as ridiculous as I did. But it was at Alamo, so we got to drink the whole thing.
Mm. That's always a plus.
Nice.
Silver lining.
In this case, 100%. So, you know, if I had Bellatro, I would have easily played a card game watching this movie. And I hate card games.
I know.
But no problem having some beers.
Cool. Well, getting back to Golden Axe. However long that show goes for, there's only one way it can end, right?
With the characters coming to life and terrorizing children in an arcade.
The camera passes, zoom back and show that it was kids playing an arcade game.
Wait, I don't think I've ever gotten far enough in Golden Axe. That
characters
happens.
Jump
you just need $10 and quarters. That's all you need to beat the game.
And they chase the
characters in the
out of the arcade.
The characters in the game burst out of an arcade machine in like a real life 80s arcade. And then the characters are like real. And
it's
then
great
run out.
Music that Damon might choose for this episode. Mm-hmm. So I had a Golden Axe cabinet. And that doesn't mean anything because they're all conversions. It's a conversion kit you get. But it was in an Asteroids Deluxe machine.
Weird.
So they had to like gut the whole thing. And the Asteroids Deluxe has a reflective monitor. So it has like a mirror and the monitor is down here and like reflects upwards at a mirror back at you. So it has this big box with like,
oh, that's cool.
Like a state fair effect. So it has these like, it looks like you're looking into like a magical world. It's really cool. But they took all that out, you know, slapped the Golden Axe stickers on the side, carved a marquee in half and put it in there, and then like took out the, you know, asteroids controls, which are buttons, and put in this. So it was this completely bastardized machine. But actually, I sold it a while ago to somebody who was very excited. But it did look cool, and it was fun to play, you know, six times ever.
I mean, it sounds like that's what the show's going to be, though, is them being in the real world. Like, isn't
What if there's a... Yeah, exactly. Like, what if there's, like, a meta like that? That would be the...
That's a pretty good premise for a
show. So it's a fish out of water show, then.
Another fish out of water, but what happens if Viking knight, barbarian, sorcerer... Mm-hmm. Are in real world,
which would be
it could be a little something like in Spider-Man.
But then we have to see how many layers of it. Like, maybe do they know their video game characters? Mm-hmm. Like, how deep is the show going to get?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
Which would be the
Death Adder,
the reverse of the 1980s Dungeons and Dragons cartoon, where it's a bunch of real world kids that get on a roller coaster and go into a tunnel, and they come out, they're in the world of Dungeons and Dragons.
Hate to
so
see it.
My memory is getting a little bit foggy now because I haven't played this game in about 15 years. But I do know that you save these magic potions and then you can do a more powerful like nuke spell, right? Mm-hmm. And I believe, what's the woman's name? She's a Valkyrie.
Tyrus.
Tyrus Flare,
yeah.
I believe. Mm-hmm. Because she has fire magic. And the fire magic's pretty cool. But her full-on fire magic is just a dragon head pops in the screen, and then I believe like a mushroom cloud happens. It's so great.
It's very cool.
Cool.
Okay.
This game blew my mind in 1989, too. I just want to point that out. Like, I'm saying things about it now, but I played it in like a pizza, like a Shakey's or something.
Yes,
in St. Louis. I don't know what the local pizza place was because I was visiting cousins. And it like blew my mind that there was games that looked like this in the arcade.
The ideal circumstance, as far as I'm concerned.
In the late 80s, 100%. In the late 80s, Sega was almost unrivaled in like arcade graphics. Like everything they put out looked amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And then Afterburner, unbelievable. I
mean, Space Harrier, all of it.
Oh man,
Space Harrier, yeah. That game was like from another planet.
Super Cobra, and then the fact that you could play this at home on your Sega Genesis was a big selling point. All right, we mentioned last episode that Darkest Dungeon 2 was trapped on PC, but now we have a release date for it on PlayStation. It's coming July 15th. I look forward to playing this one. I think it had an early access. It was a little bit
lukewarm.
Yeah,
lukewarm reception.
Now in its full release, people like it. IGN gave it an 8. So, and we talked recently about how, Nick, we talked about how it's difficult to make a sequel to a perfect roguelike game that can be played forever.
Yes. Yeah, I don't envy the team that had to put a number 2 at the end of Darkest Dungeon because that original game is just so wildly realized from beginning to end with not only just the base game, but then they outdid themselves with the DLC content. And it's like, well, surely you can't do more than this. And then they did with more DLC, and it's like, all right, you guys are done, right? You're going to do something completely different. And no, they just made a sequel. And admittedly, I have... owned the sequel since it went into early access. I don't think I've ever loaded it up, so maybe now is the time. Maybe after Fallout.
Some changes they made. It's 3D now, first of all, so in fully animated in their battle scenes. But also, it's not a dungeon crawler. It's like a road trip. You go on a stagecoach and you're traveling the countryside as you see here. That, and
those visuals alone look so cool.
Trying to make it through a mountain to a mountain. But you still have the like. Bad things that can happen to your character, afflictions, that sort of thing. They can become hopeless or selfish or diseased or anything like that. So I'm excited to try it. This is a line from our review that if anyone out there who tried Darkest Dungeon and thought it was too mean, too mean-spirited for them, our review says, "This sequel has less potential for major setbacks from party wipes that feel like pure sadistic punishment. Win or lose, you earn candles, currency that unlocks permanent bonuses and upgrades to your traveling coach, new hero types, stat buffs, and items for the random drops to pull from, so no run is really wasted." And that sounds nice.
So now it's a baby game, is what you're saying. No, I mean, I totally appreciate that. Anything that gets any people like, hey, I've heard of this. This seems like a more approachable one. Always down to allow more people to try something that maybe feels a little less daunting. But like for me, it just always scratched that part of my brain. I was like, this game is not going to hold my hand. This is going to be a game that punishes me for everything I do wrong. And sometimes it's just going to punish me for the hell of it. And I always appreciate like just friction with the player. I think a lot of games sand down that friction because they think if player gets punished for doing something incorrectly, we messed up. No, sometimes bad things just happen and you got to learn how to roll with it. And I really appreciate that about the first Darkest Dungeon.
Yeah.
They should call this one Dark-ish Dungeon.
Or Darkest Countryside. Because I don't think you're spending much time in dungeons this time around. But.
And just the art. They did a good job of retaining that art style despite like transitioning to that 3D.
Yeah. It actually looks really nice.
It's very, very cool. You could tell they had more budget for this one.
That one is coming July 15th, PS4 and PS5. But then one of the more surprising game announcements this week is a new entry in the Yars Revenge series.
Oh, wow.
What?
Yars Rising.
I didn't hear about this either. Damon caught me up. I didn't know.
Yars Rising from, Justin, get this, Way Forward.
Oh, wow. Okay. Oh, that sounds cool.
If you could graph my interest in Yars Rising, it would have been never heard of it, incredibly low. You mentioned Way Forward, and now my interest is much higher. That's great.
So the original, Yars Revenge, an Atari 2600 game, an original Atari 2600 game, not an arcade port, that I played as a kid, but I don't think I was ever able to figure out what you're supposed to do in it. You're some kind of an insect on one side of the screen, and you're shooting bullets or lasers at this other side of this fortress or whatever on the other side of the screen, knocking out blocks, but there's a force field that you can't get through. And that's just like as much as I was able to figure out.
I forget.
It has an interesting twist. It's cool.
Is Yars Revenge the arcade cabinet that always has the scary voice echoing?
No, that's Sinistar.
Oh, Sinistar. Got it.
Yeah, Yars never hit arcades. It was a straight to cartridge
game.
But I believe Howard Scott Warshaw who made E.T.
But it was definitely not a Metroidvania like we're seeing here in Yars Rising.
Mm-hmm. I mean, this looks cool.
It was not.
It's just a strange choice, I think, because who out there is like, so Yars Revenge is for the old. It's for us olds. If there are fans of Yars Revenge, they are olds. But this game is a Metroidvania with kind of like a, kind of a soft anime young adult look to it. And so these things don't seem to fit together. I don't know.
IP was free and they're like, you know what? Why not?
Well, no, like Atari's like, as a brand, is kind of back and trying to, you know, create new entries in its franchises. So they want to do Yars Revenge. They talked to Way Forward because Way Forward has often done good, you know, work for hire stuff on retro properties. But they want to turn it into a Metroidvania. Okay, this is how this happened.
We know a thing or two about making Metroidvanias here.
Shantae games are often very good. I don't know. It's just an odd.
It is weird. I mean, if they're going to tell a backstory or something, like nobody knows the story, so
exactly. We will see Yar rise.
So the press release called this a decidedly modern chapter in the storyline of Yar's Revenge, Atari's best-selling first-party game for the 2600.
Wow, that's a really interesting like trivia stat.
But not exactly true.
Scandal.
The best-selling Atari. The best-selling cartridge on the Atari 600 was Pac-Man, and it was developed and published by Atari.
That is first party. It's just we don't count it as that now.
Yars Revenge is the 20th best-selling cartridge for the 2600, but it was an original property. So I think that's what they mean. The best-selling what?
Aren't there like Breakout and things like like Combat and stuff like that above it?
I think Combat was packed in. Maybe that's why it doesn't count. Maybe that was a pack in. Although Adventure, Adventure sold more than Yars Revenge.
Yeah.
And that's
original. We're just putting whatever we want in press releases now. It doesn't matter.
That's true.
So you play as this weird little bug in Yars Revenge. Yeah. Like I can picture the game. I don't know it very well. Are you Yar? Is that Yar?
I would assume Yars.
Are you Yar in Yars Revenge?
I think Yar is the bad guy because it's Ray Kasabian's name backwards, which is Ray was the owner of CBS and Atari at the time, so it was like a diss to him. I think that's what it was, but I can't remember. But it does have a good conceit, like what you're seeing here. Like it's hard to tell. Like there's an interesting aspect to this game. Like, this is difficult to do on the Atari, right? There's like more going on in the shooter than you would normally expect.
Sure. Also hard for a, whatever, 7-year-old to figure out what to do.
Yeah. I played it the most in Atari 50, where it really explains why it's significant and neat. Mm-hmm. So check that out.
That's cool.
Yeah, well, yeah. It's really worth like understanding why this game was cool. Like using this garbage and stuff looked really neat at the time. And yeah, just it's very futuristic. This part's really cool. Like you have to go over and like nibble away at the shield and then go back across your safety area. Like it's really neat. You have to like do this risk reward.
Yes. So neat. Very cool. But not much like what we were seeing in Yars Rising. The description is, in Yars Rising, players take control of the young hacker, Emi Kimura, who is hired by a mysterious patron to infiltrate the shadowy Kotech Corporation. Run, jump, sneak, and hack away through challenges to unravel layers of intrigue in this expansive sci-fi mystery. Embark on Emi's journey to decipher the mystery of the corporation's closely guarded secret and uncover her inexplicable bond to a far-off alien race.
The Yars.
The Yars.
Yeah, and it's
coming to PC and consoles late this year.
Cyberpunk, like, setting.
Yeah.
Just very strange. Huh.
It says on the Wikipedia entry for it, it is Atari's best-selling original game for the 2600. But literally, Adventure was developed and published by Atari.
Yep. Yes. Although, if you look down to, like, the numbers sold, these are all sort of estimated at a million.
Okay.
Exactly.
So you are an insect-like creature called a Yar. So you are the Yar.
Hmm.
So here's a news story from DualShockers from 2022 that says 40-year-old Atari classic Yar's Revenge is getting a sequel, and it said Howard Scott Warshaw was working on a sequel to the game. Mm. Does not mention Way Forward, does not mention anything like that. So I don't know if that means that there's shenanigans going on under the, you know, behind the scenes or something, but like something was percolating a couple of years ago here.
Well, Yar's Revenge is back.
He did. He's really an interesting person that made the one of the most beloved Atari games, Yar's Revenge, and then famously hand game ET.
Mm-hmm. Wasn't his fault though.
He was crunched.
Here, you've got 48 hours to make a game based on ET and get it out for holidays. Right, that brings us to video game 20 questions. Our suggestion this week comes from Bryce Volrath, who says, I have a suggestion for video game 20 questions. I understand it could be difficult, but maybe the fact that it's redacted could help. I think it'd be a firm but fair challenge because your crew is really good.
This crew's good.
Can you, well,
maybe,
what's the...
Maybe the redacted is that it's licensed.
What was the redacted word?
Dang. Thought that one was going to get him.
Let the questioning begin.
Is the redacted word licensed?
No.
Oh, man. Aww. That was a great zag.
Is this from before the year 2000?
Yes.
Oh, man.
Did this appear in arcades?
No.
Did we talk about the game at any point in today's episode?
No.
Okay.
Did this game come out originally for the Sega Genesis or Super Nintendo?
No. That's 5.
Is it on the NES?
No.
Does it have 3D graphics? We're at about the 90s and damn in here.
So it sounds like it's a 2D game with the potential for some 3D elements.
Let's take a look at this.
Like Castlevania Symphony of the Night, maybe?
No, I wouldn't call that 3D elements. I mean, yeah, okay, so it's got that weird
It's got
screen.
Polygons. It's got some...
Yeah, but like...
But enough of a pause to make you research.
I got it. No, it does not have 3D graphics.
No 3D.
Nope.
Did this come out on a compact disc originally?
Yes.
Maybe it's Sewer Shark. Maybe it's a Sega CD game. okay, this game come out.
Well, what was, about was if this game about Sega consoles? Because there's Dreamcast, Saturn, and Sega CD.
That's a good question. Did this game originally come out on a Sega console?
Yes.
Oh man, it might be Sewer Shark.
3, 6, 9er.
I have such a soft spot in my heart for Sewer Shark. There's no bigger mismatch between a game that I know is objectively terrible, but that like I enjoy and like and have a fondness for. Okay, was this game originally a Sega CD game?
No, that's 10.
Okay. Oh.
Was it a Dreamcast game?
No.
Oh my gosh.
Okay, but we now, know it's a Saturn.
We're a little bit out of my territory here. I was not a Sega boy.
Saturn's difficult.
Well, but we also don't know it was exclusive to the Saturn.
No, I think it came out as PlayStation also.
Was this also available?
What was the...
Wait!
Can we read the... Sorry, can we... I want to hear the comment again, the redacted comment.
I understand it could be difficult, but maybe the fact that it's redacted could help.
Is it part of a series?
Yes.
I bet that's the redacted. Maybe it's that Mega Man game where that wasn't on Saturn.
There was no 3D graphics, right?
No 3D.
Was this game on PlayStation? Because I don't think we're gonna get this out.
Okay.
No.
Saturn exclusive. Saturn exclusive, and it's not 3D.
Yeah, not 3D.
Unless there's a disc system that this was on that was like Sega, and then.
No way! Not in the 90s.
So what do we got? We got, what is Panzer Dragoon? Is that one of them? I don't know. I don't know what came out in Saturn. It's all shooters.
Those are 3D. Yeah, there is Guardian Heroes or Guardian Legends, whatever it's called. The Brawler.
Yeah, Guardian Heroes.
Fantasy themed. That's 2D.
Part of a series.
Is it?
No, I'm saying this game has to be.
I don't think Guardian don't Heroes Guardian. Is.
I don't know. Okay, was this game developed or published by Sega?
Yes.
Do you think there was even a Sonic game on the Saturn? How'd they screw that up?
I think that's
a good question.
I think that's also part of the reason why that one had a bad time.
That's insane.
So, like, when I picture this, I never owned a Sega Saturn. Like Panzer Dragoon, Knights, they're all 3D games. Virtua Fighter, Virtua Cop.
Is Vector Man? That's Genesis, right?
Mm-hmm.
What if it's not? I just don't. Yeah. Even if it was Saturn, we're not going to get it. But are we sure it's Saturn? What do we miss here? Could it have come out on PC also?
Should we?
It's on a Sega.
How many questions are we at?
We know it was 14. Made and published. We know it was made. We know it was published by Sega because I just asked. So
right,
and
right.
It's a Saturn game.
Also, it's part of a series, so there's a lot of Sega series, you know? Like, let's just go down the list. And it's not 3D.
But we know, like it's none of the Virtua games.
Does Sega do shooters at all, like space shooters?
I don't know.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
Like, because they did...
Fantasy Star.
I'm so... Was there a Fantasy Star on the Saturn?
Sure.
I'm because like even if we were to do like their arcade games, it's like Daytona, like they're all 3D.
Mm-hmm.
And we know it didn't come out in the arcade.
Is this a role playing game?
No, that's 15.
Oh, I thought I was on to something there because there was there's like Dragon Force. Can't remember if that game's 3D or not.
It's a freaking Sega game, published by Sega in the 90s. Difficult. Part of a series.
What about, what about Radiant Silver Gun? That game's got polygons, right? But it's played from a 2D perspective.
What if we go for like the, are you a ship or are you a mascot kind of angle?
Are you a man? Yeah, I'm sad it's not an RPG because I'm remembering more now. There's Legend of Oasis. There's a few other good Saturn RPGs, but it's not any of them.
So it could be a shooter, or it could be something we're never going to.
And it's not
puzzle, like puzzle games or fighting. You know, fighting's probably all. Mean Machine. Like I don't think there's a. I can't name a Sonic game on Sega Saturn. It's crazy. But it could
maybe
be.
Sonic. There was that weird isometric 3D one. Sonic 3D Blast.
Called Sonic 3D Blast.
I can't remember if that, I think that was on, yeah, I think it was a Genesis game.
Do you play as a vehicle in the game?
No.
Okay, so you play as some sort of humanoid. Or mascot, yeah, like animal mascot. So it's not like, it's not a shooter, like a Radiant Silver Gun or anything like that.
You're not a vehicle.
Is there FMB games that we're missing that were holdovers from the Sega CD?
Not that I can think of.
How do we eliminate Sega CD again?
Because we asked if it was a Sega CD game, and the answer was no.
Do we ask?
Oh, I don't know. Oh. I don't know if Sega. So there's Saturn Bomberman, which was famous because it had, I think it was the one that had 10 players in it, and people love it. So it's Hudson, obviously, but Sega may have published it. I mean, it's got Saturn in the damn name.
It does.
Yeah, it's called Saturn Bomberman. I don't know if Sega's involved in the making of that game.
You asked if it was developed or published. So it could have been published.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. Okay. So okay, does this game have multiplayer?
Yes.
Oh, maybe you're onto something. How many do we have left?
Two questions and a guess.
I don't know a smart way to narrow it down.
Maybe something about mascots? It's... Like, does it feature... Like, I'm not asking this, but, like, does it feature any... does it feature an iconic mascot? Does it feature like a mascot?
Yeah. Iconic is awfully generous.
Did this get
Bomberman.
A gritty 2000s era remake?
That may not... There may be more than one of those... Let's take a beat and recap, and then I know we're running long. So like, okay, so we know it's a Saturn game. We know it's 2D made or published by Sega on the Saturn. It's not part of a license. It's not part of, and it is part of a series. It's totally okay. Is this game you shooting off bombs in this game?
Yes.
Is it Saturn
Bomberman? Did it get a gritty remake in the 90s?
A gritty Xbox 360.
Yes, it is Saturn Bomberman.
Hey.
Oh, this looks cool.
Not 3D.
Saturn Bomberman. I've never played it, but I know it has a reputation as being like, you know, the best, most beloved Bomberman game there is.
10 player multiplayer mode.
This looks gorgeous.
And a 10 player multiplayer mode that like EGM used to like write about, and I was always jealous.
Do you think it was like a bank of controllers that you used?
You had to like daisy chain multiple multi-taps together. Amazing. I don't know how you could get to 10, because I think the multi-tap was 4. And so you would plug one into one and one into two, and that got you to 8. I guess I don't know. I've never played it. Maybe the multi-tap was 5 controllers, and that was how they did it.
Named by IGN, one of the top 10 Sega Saturn games.
Next game night.
Mm-hmm. And, Sam, there are 3 Sonic games on the Saturn. Sonic 3D Blast, Sonic R, and Sonic Jam.
What is Sonic Jam? I've been a video game journalist my entire life. I've never heard of Sonic Jam.
And what's Sonic R?
Sonic R is the racing game. That was the okay. I think it's. Yeah, I think you're on foot.
Foot race one, yeah.
Sonic Jam.
Yeah.
Well, it looks terrible.
What is this?
Well,
3D game. Oh, cool. 3D adventure game.
Oh, this looks like proto Sonic Adventure.
Yeah,
totally does. Wow.
And then Sonic 3D Blast, I'm pretty sure that did come out for Genesis too.
Yeah, I think about it as a Genesis game.
Sega Saturn is a very interesting console. We've said this before, I really recommend everyone out there read Console Wars and the story of how Sega North America and Thomas Kalinske, you know, crawled back and made the Sega Genesis a success with an incredible marketing campaign and getting all sorts of like really good games out in the library. And then all of their progress was just totally torpedoed by Sega of Japan and the Sega Saturn.
Yep.
When they saw, you know, everyone saw the industry was moving to 3D, and Sega of Japan was like, no, we're sticking with 2D.
Damn.
That was the beginning of the end for Sega there. Good story.
I remember Sonic Jam now, by the way. It was a compilation game that had Sonic 1, okay. 2, 3, and Knuckles. And then the 3D was like a museum mode where you could walk around.
Oh.
I'd completely forgotten that existed.
Well, nicely job. Thank you for the suggestion. Bryce Volrath, viewers, listeners.
Oh, wait. Did we get the reveal of what the...
It was part of a series.
It was? Okay, yeah. Good.
Yep. Cool. I mean, I told you that in the game.
No.
Viewers, listeners, if you have your own suggestions for Video Game 20 questions, email them to me at the email address gamescoop@ign.com. Tonight it's Star Wars night at Disneyland, and my wife and I are going without the kids. It's going to be good.
Ooh.
Nice.
It's going to be fun. That's all the scoops that we have for you this week. Thank you, Nick. Thank you, Sam. Thank you, Justin. Thank you to Jobert working behind the scenes to make this episode possible. My name is Damon. This is IGN Game Scoop, and we're out.
Nick, what have you heard about Sasquatch Sunset?
I've heard very similar things as you, that it's like a silent film, essentially, with some heartful human moments. But I'm just like, yeah.
Charlie Chaplin just takes a shit on everything all the time?
I mean, Charlie Chaplin would be probably more entertaining than this.
Yeah.
I don't really have any interest. Maybe I'll watch it when it's streaming at some point. Throw it on in the background of like summer hang with the boys. Just throw it on.
For this one, maybe you want to play like a really engaging game.
It'd be the game that I probably throw on at like we're playing cards or something, like some sort of card game with friends.
Oh, that's smart. Yeah.
You should do the second screen experience, but in reverse. Have Sasquatch on your phone, and then you're playing Call of Duty on your television.
Yeah, just make sure your card friends realize that it's going to be full frontal, completely prosthetic nudity for the entire 2 hours.
Great.
We're all silly film dorks, so it all works out always.
Well, you're going to see a lot of silly film dorks on the front of the Sasquatches.
Hello, dear stranger. I'd like to introduce you to something new, or perhaps something very, very old. The Heresies of Radolf Burntwine is a horror fantasy medical mystery following the titular monk turned traveling medical investigator. Follow Radolf as he navigates a nightmare world in which viruses are gods and the human race are not their favored children. Steeped in history and an aesthetic that can only be described as a combination of occult academia and laboratory Judaica, the Heresies of Radolf Burntwine have been described as Umberto Eco meets H.P. Lovecraft. For more information, check out the Patreon at thorb.info. But take care, dear stranger, for some truths are best left unknown.